This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Good morning. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. Richard Pollock filling in. It's the final show in the host chair for Drew Mandel, who will be returning next Saturday. Joined in studio by Ezra Ginsberg and David Manuk of IllegalCurve.com. Today's show, this morning's show, pardon me, we have Pat Hickey of the Montreal Gazette joining us next segment, in fact, to talk about the Habs' hot start against the Tampa Bay Lightning. Up 2-0. The underdog, some would say, we'll break that down. Pat Hickey next segment at the top of the next hour at 10 a.m. You're going to hear from Aaron Portsline of the Columbus Dispatch. We're going to break down the Columbus-Pittsburgh series. Columbus blew a couple leads in the first game. You wonder how they'll react as a little bit of a young team with not a lot of playoff experience, against a seasoned Pittsburgh squad. We're going to talk to Josh Cooper at 11 a.m. about Barry Trotz being let go from Nashville, where Barry Trotz might end up, why really he was let go at the end of the day, and who could be the replacement for the only coach the Nashville Predators have ever known in Nashville, Tennessee. And then Tom Lynn, a Veritas Hockey former assistant general manager with the Minnesota Wild for many years, was going to join us to talk about an interesting topic. I don't know if you caught it the other day. It was the NCAA Frozen Four went on. And before that, TSN had an article about how many Canadians were playing in the conference tournament. So we're going to talk to Tom about why so many Canadians are now playing in the NCAA and whether that's becoming a little bit more of a trend than it has in the past, 10 to 15 years. But first, guys, good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Richie. What's going on?
You know, I want to get right into the playoffs, guys. And I want to ask you about the Montreal-Tampa game. And how surprised are you that the Habs have a 2-0 lead and they haven't played a home game yet?
Yeah, it's a good point. I'm not surprised at all. I picked the Montreal Canadiens in the series. In fact, I think we all picked the Montreal Canadiens in the series. Maybe surprised they're up 2-0, but not surprised because I had them in the mm-hmm. series. And I think they are a better team. I think right now what you're seeing is a Tampa Bay Lightning, especially last night, Richie, without Andre Palat on the top line. He's been a mainstay on that top line with Steven Stamkos, and he didn't play in Game 2. We're not quite sure about his status for Game 3, but he led the team in scoring this year. Of course, if Steven Stamkos was healthy, he would have easily led the team in scoring, but he had a great rookie year nonetheless. But this is a Montreal Canadiens team that I think made the perfect acquisitions, and we'll talk to Pat Hickey about it, but mm-hmm. you add Thomas Vanek to a team that didn't really have trouble scoring goals. They've had trouble scoring goals on the power play, but Vanek has just made this team, a good team, even better. So I think what they've done is score a whole lot of goals. We've seen them score 9 goals now in 2 games, which is really impressive because, as we know, in the playoffs, things tighten up quite a bit. So I'm a little bit surprised at how dominant they were yesterday. But in Game 1, even though they outshot the Tampa Bay Lightning 2-1, the Habs that is, they really got away with one there because Price didn't play very well, and then Anders Lindback wasn't good, and of course we saw him pulled yesterday for Gudlevskis. So I'm not surprised, but maybe a little bit surprised in how many goals they've scored and how poor Tampa Bay played yesterday.
You know, it's hard to call it an away game when there were so many Habs fans mm-hmm. in the crowd in Tampa Bay. So, I mean, that was interesting because, every time Montreal scored, their cheer went through the crowd.
That would happen.
Yeah, no. Not surprising, but it was just funny because, you heard the USA, USA chants just because obviously there were a lot of Canadians mm-hmm. in the crowd. Montreal's looked fantastic. I thought Carey Price he's shut it down. I mean, he mm-hmm. gave up, after giving up the 4 goals, I think he made like 19 or 20 straight saves. He was the difference maker in Game 2, I thought, and the Habs played as a team. Vanek looked great. I mean, he's the missing piece, I think, for what's really been, in terms of being a catalyst for scoring on this team.
I think what's interesting about Vanek is 2 things. The first of which is he's a natural left winger, but has agreed to move to the right side and is playing on the right side of a line with Desharnais and Pacioretty, and they seem to complement each other really well. Pacioretty with the skating and shooting ability. Vanek can score as well, but he's not the fastest skater. He's a great stick handler, can see the ice really well. I think the other thing is, Vanek's a little bit soft, and there's certain aspects to his game, not great defensively, but he fits into a pecking order in Montreal that I think suits him just right. In terms of popularity and attention, probably below Pacioretty and certainly below Subban and Price. And I think he has comfort in that. And I think that's why he's playing so well. One of the reasons, of course. Other reasons of the chemistry, offensive ability, all those things. But I think there's a comfort level there because you're playing in a hockey hotbed. but you're not necessarily right under the spotlight.
Right, and he was under the spotlight in Buffalo, and he was under the spotlight for the Islanders. The Islanders, you remember, if you remember, they went out and acquired him to turn their season around. They didn't acquire him to take this team over the top. The Islanders were struggling, and they ended up struggling for most of the year. But I think you're right, Richie. I think this team has a lot of weapons, and I think you see Rene Bork having an excellent game. Rene Bork was a guy who was a healthy scratch many times during this season. He had trouble scoring goals. He hasn't put up numbers anywhere close to what he put up when he was playing with Jerome Iginla in Calgary. And I think you can roll out four good lines. And, you know, Vanek has really just, he's been a great fit. He's fit in really nicely there. And that line right now is their top line, not just in the sense that they get the most minutes, but really they're producing on a nightly basis.
I want to move to Detroit in a second, but I will say this. Tampa Bay's performance thus far and the lack of composure, I think, from John Cooper, although he's trying to act composed, I think he's lost composure, reminds me a lot of Montreal's performance last year.
Well, Richie, this is a guy who has no playoff experience on a team that doesn't have a lot of playoff experience. And that starts with their best player and it goes down the lineup. Sure, you have some guys. Phil Pula is a guy who has some playoff experience. Brewer, I think, has looked really bad. And I think you can look at a guy like Eric Brewer.
He's getting beaten numerous times out there.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of his, but he's had a lot of problems with Montreal's speed, and you hear that a lot.
But also, his reads on those plays were bad.
Yeah, they were. And Sammy Salo didn't have a very good game. His decision making was poor. So I think the Montreal Canadiens have basically stepped on the gas early on in the series and really haven't taken their foot off the gas, and they seem to be scoring goals easily, even late in the game yesterday when you were expecting a pushback from Tampa Bay. Rene Bork scores that goal and really deflates everything, and then before that, I should say, Brendan Gallagher got the third goal, which chased Lindback from the net. But I really think that they are having trouble with their speed. And I always thought, I don't want to go back to this because it is the regular season, but I always thought the Lightning were a little bit overrated. They're in a bad division. This defense isn't terrific. They've got some offensive minded defensemen, but I always had concerns going into the playoffs that this group, a guy like Gudas. Sure, tough guy, dropped the gloves with Pruss, but he's not a guy that you can put out there in your top two pairs and expect him to shut down the likes of Vanek and Pacioretty and Gionta and these guys.
It's a team speed, too. I think it's a factor. As you know, I thought Tampa, like Carl, guys like Carl and can skate, right? A guy like Matt Carl, move the puck and can skate. And Hedman is a big guy who can skate. So they have some guys who can skate. You know, Salo has slowed down a bit, and so is Brewer. And fine. Gudas isn't a great skater, but I thought overall the puck moving ability and the big guys who can move the puck, I thought would be okay in Tampa against, you know, a smaller but quicker Montreal team, and they've proven to be able to take advantage of the Brewer-Salo, both of those guys, quite a bit. And Gudas' lack of speed certainly hurts them. I think they might, you wonder how Tampa will come out matchup wise in the next game, because they have to change it up a bit. And obviously, we haven't talked about Ben Bishop. That's a huge injury, and Lindback hasn't been good enough. And Gudlevskis, is that how to pronounce his name? I always get it wrong.
Gudlevskis.
I mean, he gets beat on the wraparound.
Edgars. Is it Edgars? Oscars. It's his first name. Christers. Yeah.
There's Remus there. Gives us a thumbs up on that one. But, the thing is, the wraparound, too, he gets beat on there. I mean, I don't know. You could certainly take issue with
it. He was cold,
it.
Though. I mean, he had just come into the game.
Right. And if you're relying on your third netminder, you're likely in trouble anyways, unless you're Anaheim.
Yeah.
Who's voluntarily relying on their second netminder, although third netminder coming into the season when they had Victor Fast, and then John Gibson sitting there, and he could be the best of the three, to be honest with you, of Hiller, Anderson, and Gibson. That's another story, though. Detroit-Boston last night, guys. A game. Detroit, kind of controls that middle period there. Boston comes out, really controls the third period. But Pavel Datsyuk with a brilliant move in the neutral zone to pull the puck from behind him with one hand, away from Bergeron and Marchand, and then to shoot the puck through Dougie Hamilton's legs. And it's a weak goal, but Tuukka Rask has to have that goal. And I don't like the way Hamilton played that play, but obviously due credit goes to a tremendous player in Pavel Datsyuk. It's 1-0. Jimmy Howard was great. Mike Babcock looks in control. As I say, best coach of his generation by a mile, as far as I'm concerned. And Claude Julien's a good coach, too. What do you take from Game 1 in Boston last night between the Red Wings and the Bruins?
Well, aside from Milan Lucic's little...
That's in rapid fire.
What do we call it?
That's in rapid fire.
What was the word we were calling it? Well, let's just call it. It was a nice little shot to the nether regions.
Yes.
But no, the game itself, it comes down to when you're in the playoffs and you're down to the third period, anything can happen. And when you've got a guy like Pavel Datsyuk on the ice, he basically takes it upon himself to win the game for the Detroit Red Wings. And of course, it was an incredible move that Datsyuk has, and I think his stick is an extra 6 inches. Seems like that stick is almost as long as Tobias Enstrom's stick. But Jimmy Howard is great, and in this game, Jimmy Howard just happens to be that one save better than Tuukka Rask. Really, it comes down to that. And the Detroit Red Wings, I thought, were aggressive. They don't have their captain in Henrik Zetterberg, and they played a smart game. You mentioned this, Richie. I was listening to you on H&L, and you were right, and this is exactly what their game plan was. Stay out of the penalty box against the Boston Bruins. They did that. Roll four lines. Try to keep the game low scoring. Be aggressive, and that's what they did. And Jimmy Howard, a guy that kind of has gotten forgotten there, even though it was a little bit controversial that he was the third goalie, because I think we'd all agree Ben Bishop was playing better, and he could have been the
Olympics,
goalie there in the Olympics, I should say. But they kept it low scoring, and they really, when you come out of the opposing team's building with a 1-0 victory, it doesn't really matter if you didn't score a lot of goals. They played well. It was tight checking, and they came out with the victory, and it's really impressive, because I don't think there were that many people picking. I certainly didn't. I didn't pick the Detroit Red Wings to win the series, and to go out of that, to leave that building last night with a 1-0 victory is a huge moral victory for that team, because as we know, they don't have a problem playing the underdog role.
You know what? It's amazing. I don't think there's anybody who plays chess like Mike Babcock. I mean, the guy just knows how to coach. He can go in there, and he was getting the matchups he wanted. Like, he, you know, you're the visiting coach. You generally don't get the matchups you want. He seemed to be getting the matchups he wanted throughout the game. And the Red Wings just played their game, which is, you know, they didn't feel like this is a team that doesn't have as much playoff experience as the Boston Bruins, at least recent playoff experience, I should say. And they played a great game, and they played the perfect kind of away game. And you saw them come away with a 1-0 victory. I thought Jimmy Howard was pretty good. Mm-hmm. It's just amazing to show you puck luck, though, right? Because, like, he had that puck that just missed, went through, caught the end of his foot, could have completely changed the dynamic of the game. Doesn't. The Red Wings come back, and Datsyuk gets that goal. So, I mean, it was just an interesting little chess match, I thought, between those two really, you know, kind of an interesting team, because the Red Wings played Boston throughout the regular season, and they beat him 3-1.
So. Well, and I'm not surprised that Detroit's giving them a run for their money, because Detroit also, you know, it's that ability to not engage Boston in their style, right? That is the key to me. Detroit's not, you're going to hit a guy on the forecheck, and Boston's going to come in, Lucic is going to nail a guy to the boards, and that guy's going to get up and just keep skating. And he's not going to engage them, and Boston wants you to play their game. Like, Boston would play Philly, and Boston would beat Philly at their game. That's what I think. Because Philly would engage them, and Boston's better at it. But against Detroit, I think Boston is a better team, but it doesn't mean Detroit can't give them a run for their money because of the discipline they exhibit and the talent level they have. And I think another thing is the puck-moving skating ability of their defense is certainly a factor in their ability to not play in their own zone as much as obviously Boston would like.
And Richie, it is one game.
You can't
get too excited on one game,
of course.
But it's important because of the way, as you mentioned, they played their style, they kept it low scoring, and you steal a game on the road, and that takes home ice advantage away.
Mike Babcock said in his post game interview that if you're the eighth seed, that's what he's viewing himself as, the eighth seed or the bottom seed, and you lose game one, you wonder if you're good enough. He says, We knew we were good enough, but now after this win, the team knows we're good enough to beat Boston, and I think that belief in themselves will go a long way to determining whether or not the Wings are able to beat the Bruins in this series. When we come back, Pat Hickey of the Montreal Gazette to further break down the Habs Lightning. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.
Richard Pollock in the host chair for Drew Mindell this Saturday morning. Joined in studio by Ezra Ginsberg and David Manuk of IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We're joined on the IC Hotline by Pat Hickey of the Montreal Gazette. He's joining us from Tampa, Florida, or en route to the airport, I believe. Pat, how are you this morning?
I'm doing just fine, guys.
Well, Pat, we have to start. I mean, the Habs obviously go into Tampa Bay. They win both games as the road team. What do you think has been the key to their success in the first two games of this series?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. One is their scoring goals. That's something that they had problems with during the regular season. Of course, they were facing Ben Bishop, and his win-back isn't quite the same as Ben Bishop. So they got a bit of a break there. But the other thing is that they're playing their system. They're playing the game plan. They're putting a lot of pressure on the Lightning, and the Lightning has had trouble getting out of their own zone. They've been bottled up a little bit. Steven Stamkos did well in the first game, but last night, he wasn't quite as effective. And Carey Price is just playing great. I mean, his first game, I don't think he was very comfortable. I think there were some nerves there, but he played really well in the overtime. He had 9 shots, and he stopped them all. And I think that gave him some momentum going into the game last night. He had a shutout until about 3 minutes to go, and so he's playing the kind of hockey that we saw during the Olympics. He had a very strong finish to the regular season, and he's just having an outstanding year.
Pat, David Desharnais finally scored a power play goal for the Montreal Canadiens yesterday on a really nice feed from PK Subban. But as you wrote about in the Montreal Gazette, that was their first power play goal in 10 games dating back to the regular season. I know Michel Therrien in his press conference said it's still not an issue for the team, but do you think their lack of power play success is a concern going forward?
Well, you know, it is if they stop scoring goals 5-on-5. And for the longest time this year, the Canadians were 22nd, 23rd, 24th in the league in scoring, and particularly in the 5-on-5 goals, they were 28th in the league. So they weren't scoring many goals at even strength. Since Thomas Vanek arrived, it's changed a little bit. Not only is that top line with Vanek, Desharnais, and Pacioretty scoring goals, but it's just the depth right through the line. It's when they're playing well, teams have to concentrate on them, and it you know, takes a little of a pressure off some of the other lines. So they've been getting first game they had goals from each of the 4 lines. Last night they had 3 different lines sharing in the scoring. So they're getting some real good secondary scoring, and that's been an issue for a long time.
Habs captain Brian Johnson seems to always step up his game around the playoff time and has had a big shorthanded goal in game 1. How important is his veteran presence on this team?
Well, I think it's important. I think his best veteran presence, Neil Briere's veteran presence. Mm-hmm. He's a guy who's averaged a point a game during the playoffs over 109 games now, 110 games. And so he's very important. He's one of these guys who steps it up. He's been there. He understands what the playoffs are about. Vanek less so. One of the things that's interesting, you know, you talk about the inexperience on the part of the Tampa Bay Lightning, and they do have 9 or 10 guys who've never played a playoff game before this year. But you look, for example, Max Pacioretty, who's been the Canadiens' leading scorer. He only had 4 games coming into this series. And so, you know, you need those veterans to calm the guys down, tell them what it's like to play in playoff games and how to handle that pressure that comes with it.
We're joined by Pat Hickey of the Montreal Gazette talking about the Habs' 2-0 lead so far on Tampa Bay, heading back to the Bell Center. Pat, when you look at the Tampa Bay Lightning, I see John Cooper, you know, saying, oh, we didn't play that poorly, or then maybe we did play poorly, and the message seems to be a little bit mixed, and you talk about the veteran presence on the Habs. It seems that the Lightning have lost their composure a little bit. Would you agree with that?
Well, I think they have lost their composure. I think when they went down 3-0 last night, I think that you could just see the whole team sag. And even when they were down 2-0, it looked like they were having some problems out there. You know, they just seemed to feel that, you know, there was no way they were going to win that. And I know that that's one of the reasons why Cooper, for example, pulled the goaltender. Replaced Lindback with Gudrowski's. And then you had the other situation where he pulled the goaltender for the extra attacker with about 3 minutes to go. And I think he was trying to send a message to the team, look, we got to keep fighting. Mm-hmm. We got to keep at it. And, you know, I'm not sure whether, I think it's one of those things where they have to regroup. They just did not respond very well when they fell behind. And I think that overtime loss took a little bit out of them, particularly since they, you know, in the beginning of the game, it looked like they were doing a pretty good job of controlling the play. And then Montreal just shut them down. And so that's one of the things. The 2-0 lead, I think one of the reasons that Cooper's not really, you know, trying to be positive about the thing is that there are a couple of factors. One is that the Tampa Bay Lightning won both of their regular season games in Montreal this year. Mm-hmm. And John Cooper said, if you have to go on the road, that's the place you want to go at. And he says when his tenure, they've done very well. The two Florida teams have both have pretty good records against the Canadians. So that's something that, you know, gives them a little bit of hope. The other factor that goes into it is that the last three times the Canadians have won the first two games on the road, they've lost the series.
Pat, along
49-5 when they go up 2-0, but the last three times, at one point they were 49-2.
Pat, you mentioned Thomas Vanek earlier, and along with Thomas Vanek, Mike Weaver has been a great trade deadline acquisition for this team, and it only cost them a 2015 fifth-round pick, and now he finds himself paired up with Francois Bouillon there on the third pairing there, and he's become a mainstay for the Habs. What's his greatest attribute as a defenseman, and why is Therrien so confident in using him every night?
Well, I think one of the things is, you know, being a veteran, he understands what he can and cannot do. He doesn't take any unnecessary risks, and that's a very important factor in Therrien's play. The other thing is he's tough. He's a small guy, but he hits hard. He makes a good first pass. He doesn't do anything particularly in a spectacular. You don't notice him out there on the ice, but he doesn't make any mistakes, and that's the key, especially in that third defense pairing, and. You know, they had basically taking Douglas Murray's spot, and Douglas Murray is bigger. He's a better hitter. He's probably about the same on the PK, but Weaver is far more mobile than Murray is. And here's a guy who's at the end of his contract. He's 36 in another month, but I wouldn't be surprised if he gets another couple of years out of his career the way he's playing.
Pat, Montreal's fourth line of Bourneval, Weiss, and Briere played a key role in Game 1's 5-4 victory, while Rene Bourque had two goals in Game 2. Is the production of these players a reflection of how good the team's overall forward depth is?
Well, I think this is something they've been talking about all year, that they have a lot of forward depth, but it hasn't always shown up on the score sheet. But I think that if you saw Rene Bourque play in the first period last night, you could see that he was excited, he had a lot of jump. This is a guy who has a lot of tools, but it just doesn't always show up in the games. He's been benched for a couple of games, just a healthy scratch for a couple of games on two occasions this season. One of the things that's interesting, though, is every time that he is a healthy scratch, he seems to come back with some renewed vigor. And two of the three times he was a healthy scratch, he came back and scored a goal in his first game back. This time around, I think that Michel Therrien is hoping that there's a little more consistency over a prolonged period. But he says that ever since the last benching, which was about 3 weeks ago, Rene Bourque has played really well.
Pat, final question for you. We know you're heading back home. I guess with the Habs taking a 2-0 lead, we do have to ask, possibly looking forward, Alex Galchenyuk, any update on his status in terms of being available for maybe later in this series or more likely the second or third round?
Yeah, I think that particularly since they're winning, they won't try to rush him back. The original plan was to have him back for the second round, and I think that's still pretty well on track. The other thing is Travis Mullen. There's also a possibility that he'll be back. The interesting thing is, you know, fitting those two guys in and without destroying the chemistry that they have right now, and that will be an interesting. I think that they'll find a spot for Galchenyuk. I'm not so sure about Travis Mullen.
Pat Hickey, the Montreal Gazette. Thanks so much for joining us, Pat, this Saturday afternoon, and enjoy the rest of the series.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure talking to Pat. He gives us his time. Very, very appreciative of that. When we come back, San Jose's up 1-0, St. Louis is up 1-0, and Colorado's up 1-0. We're going to talk about all those series on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, live on TSN 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
On TSN1290.ca.
Halfway through the first hour on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. Richard Pollack, Ezra Ginsberg, at David Manuk of IllegalCurve.com. Producer Tim Debenham and Michael Remus all giving us a great hand today. Guys, this segment's brought to you by Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, the longest-running independent comedy club in North America. For over 25 years, Rumors has been bringing Winnipeg the best in stand-up comedy. To purchase tickets or for a list of performers and showtimes, visit rumorscomedyclub.com. Gentlemen, I look at the San Jose-LA series, and I want to start there just because that was probably the most shocking first the result of the first game that we saw. San Jose came out like a house on fire, and it looked like LA had no answer for them, at least until the third period when the game was long over. What was your first impressions? Let me ask it this way. What part of LA's performance or lack thereof surprised you most?
Well, first off, Richie, LA is not used to allowing that many goals. So they were absolutely shell-shocked there in the first, I guess, 20, 30 minutes of that game. San Jose went up 5-0. They were able to make it somewhat respectable in the third period and get three goals there. But the LA Kings are a team that prides themselves on their defense. They're the best defensive team in the league. Maybe not just by numbers, but their group of defensemen. Mm-hmm. Sure, Chicago is very good, and St. Louis, you can throw in some other teams there too. Boston is a good defensive team. But as we've seen here at the MTS Center when they've played the Jets, the LA Kings are structured, and they love to play not just low-scoring games because they can jump on teams offensively, but they love to keep the games low scoring. So I think that the San Jose Sharks caught them off guard because the San Jose Sharks came at them hard. They were aggressive. There were, I think, like 110 combined hits in that game. It was a very physical game. Mm-hmm. I think they came at them really hard, and I think that they were having trouble. And that's with the three lines. Hurdle is back now, and Pavelski, who's a natural center, they put him with Thornton there on the first line. And I think that caused problems as well. And if you look at it, there was goals coming from all three lines there. And I think that you have to decide who you're going to try to stop. And I think that the Thornton line was good, but I also think that the Couture line was also good. So I think that they were kind of a little bit taken aback by the fact that how hard San Jose was coming there. And I think that in this series, I think you're going to see more low-scoring games. But I think that it was one of those games that, and also, Jonathan Quick didn't have his best game. I don't think you can put it all on Jonathan Quick, because I think the San Jose Sharks played well. They deserve credit. But I also don't think they're ever expecting Jonathan Quick to let in five goals.
Darryl Sutter said in the post-game press conference that he didn't have his team ready. That was on him, partly on him, to get his team better prepared for game two. Do you think that they weren't prepared, David, or do you think it was just San Jose was so ramped up, ready to go, and LA plays such a calm style somewhat? Obviously, they're aggressive, but they like to play a certain way, and as soon as they got behind two goals, that way they probably realized wasn't going to lead to a win in game one.
Yeah, you know what? I really thought San Jose just played a very good game. Like, I think you have to credit San Jose for playing their game. They came out, they dominated, they played a physical game. They mm-hmm. weren't afraid to mix it, which we're not surprised by.
But no, LA's the more physical team.
No, there's no question. Yeah. LA plays a heavier style, but I'm saying that San Jose was able to match it. And you really saw, like, they took it to them. They pressed them offensively. They scored the goals early on, and then that really kind of, like you said, Rich, they took the wind out of LA's sails. And then at that point, you're sitting there going, okay, well, we no longer can play that control game. What are we going to do? Well, we have to kind of open up our game. We saw what happened. Okay. And then probably the best thing, because we were talking about it while the game was ongoing, and I think it was like 4-0 at that point. And you're like, well, if you're San Jose, you don't want this, because at this point, you're almost embarrassing the other team. Mm-hmm. So when this final score, I think it was 6-3. So when the final score is 6-3, you've got a team that says, it's San Jose, we didn't embarrass them, so they can't really use that as kind of like their, you know, mantra to get ramped up for game two if you're LA. So San Jose can kind of come back with that same sort of aggressive style in game two, you'd hope from a San Jose perspective, and LA has to kind of reconfigure, or maybe they don't. Maybe Darryl Sutter says, okay, I'm going back in there and I wasn't prepared. Because let's be realistic. Of course he was prepared. His team just didn't show up. Right. But he's going to take it because he's the coach and that's what he wants. He can't throw his entire team under the bus after one game. Nor should he after one game. You didn't play a great game. That's fine. But there's always game two.
And Darryl Sutter's a Stanley Cup champion. Yeah. He went to the finals with the Calgary Flames. I think he knows that there's certain elements of the game, maybe not just strategically, Richie, but maybe mentally this team just wasn't there. Because when you go down that bad that early, you know, maybe your heads were in the wrong place. I'm not saying that the LA Kings maybe are not as good as we thought they were, because I think I still picked them to win the series. It's only one game.
I think that what they are, though, is I think they are a team that plays better when motivated. I'm not saying every other team doesn't, but I think LA is one of those veteran teams that needs to be pushed to play well. I think Mike Richards needs to be pushed to a different level to play well, and I think maybe this game helps them do that, because I think sometimes they're a little bit asleep at the wheel. They realize the talent, they realize that they've won before, they realize they went to the conference finals last year. Sometimes they can do it a little easier than other teams, and I think they need that push, and I think game one probably was that push for them. I think you're going to see a different team, no surprise, in game two. I want to move Ezzy to St. Louis and Chicago. exciting game. Chicago blows the lead late in the game. We've seen a lot of blown leads thus far. And then the beginning of third overtime, Steve Ott, nice pass to Alex Steen. There's a coverage breakdown, I think, by Chicago in terms of the read with Oduya and Chalmerson. And you see St. Louis with a 1-0 lead. I personally thought that St. Louis was clearly not as good as Chicago in that game. I thought Chicago ought to have won that game. Ryan Miller made some great saves in overtime on Patrick Sharp, on Jonathan Toews, and some great saves throughout the game after he calmed down a bit. And Corey Crawford played well, too. But what do you guys make of Game 1 there? Because if they had lost, St. Louis had lost there, there would have been 7 games in a row, including the regular season. How important was it for them to win, and what do you see happening for Game 2?
It was very important, Richie, because as you mentioned, Chicago, and I agree with you, Chicago played better in that game.
Yeah.
And I think that when you look at these two teams, to beat the Chicago Blackhawks, and we saw this at the beginning of last year, the lockout shortened year, when they won 24 games, or not won 24 games, but they weren't defeated in regulation in 24 games, you have to really play your best game. And they didn't play their best game, but I think it's important in the sense that the Chicago Blackhawks, I think, are a better defensive team. But if you look at that game, they were getting contributions from the lower lines. Steve Ott has been forced to play on that first line with the injury to TJ Oshie, and he had that pass to Alex Steen. He played well, but he's a guy that's most likely going to be on the third and fourth lines for the rest of the series. Oshie and Berglund skated yesterday, so they might come back. But back to your question, I think it is important for them to get that first win, because the St. Louis Blues, and you mentioned this when we did the preview here, Richie, this is a Western Conference final here that we're getting in the first round. And that game, the triple OT game Thursday night, was absolutely incredible. Back and forth, but you also had the goalies were playing well, the defense was playing well, yet you had so many goals. So I think you are going to see a lot of goals in the series. And I think as the series goes on, it's going to tighten up. But for the St. Louis Blues, a team, as you remember, last year that was up 2-0 on the LA Kings.
Yep.
And what did they do? They blew it. So for this team, one game means nothing. Two games means nothing. But it means something because you don't want to be behind on the Chicago Blackhawks right. When you're at home and you have home ice advantage. You fought all year to get home ice advantage. So I think it's important. But, I want to just mention that even though it's an impressive triple OT victory, we know that Chicago, Patrick Sharp breakaway away from, Chicago taking game one. So even though it's nice and all that, I still think that unless St. Louis gets healthy, Oshie and Berglund, those guys, they're going to need those guys because I don't think you can count on the Steve Ott's, the Adam Cracknells to get all your goals. Even though it's nice to see the fourth line, third and fourth line guys get the goals, mm-hmm. The Chicago Blackhawks have so much talent there that they need to be healthy if they're going to win this series.
Jonathan Toews, David, is a guy who we know. I mean, to me, he's a modern-day Mark Messier. But favoring a shoulder at almost every time there's contact, how concerned are you about that?
Oh, well, when he got hit by Winnipeg's Ryan Reeves into the boards, he just looked like he was in so much pain. And you saw him just holding his shoulder, and his shoulder was basically limp. And, how tough is he that he's clearly still favoring that shoulder?
Yeah, he's not 100%.
He's not 100%, which, the reality is nobody's 100% when you come into the playoffs at this point in the season. But the fact of the matter is, you can just see the level of pain he's in when he's skating out there, and after taking a hit like that, and it's impressive that he's even playing, to be honest with you, because I didn't think he was going to make it.
You're listening to the Legal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. We're breaking down the first round series by series as we do. Guys, I want to move over to a different series, and that's Colorado Minnesota. Well, what a game that was. What a game one that was. You saw Patrick Waugh pulling goalie earlier than most do. You saw a late goal under 15 seconds left by the Avs, obviously winning in overtime. Minnesota blowing a two-goal lead. Brizgalov letting a goal through him in overtime. When you look at this series, guys, how concerned are you about Brizgalov being the guy for Minnesota if they're going to be able to win this series?
And we were concerned heading into the series because he's not a guy that's a number one goaltender in the NHL. And I mentioned this when we were still doing the midweek show. Mm-hmm. I still think it was really impressive what he did towards the end of the regular season. His numbers were excellent, and he provided them a veteran goalie that they needed. The Minnesota Wild have had the biggest goaltending carousel. They've gone now to a fourth option, mm-hmm. because it was Nicklas Backstrom and then Harding and then Kemper and then now Brizgalov. I'm concerned, absolutely, Richie. The Minnesota Wild were in a position up two goals And to take that game in Colorado would have been massive. And Brizgalov didn't play well. And I know that Colorado is a great offensive team. But it is deflating when you have that lead and the Colorado comes back late. And you got to give credit. Paul Stastny was excellent there towards the end. And Ryan O'Reilly had a great game. But I'm absolutely concerned. I think that if Josh Harding's in net, I picked the Avalanche in five, I believe. So I think if they have Josh Harding in net, maybe not so much Darcy Kuemper. I'd have my concerns with Kuemper. He's got no playoff experience. Neither does Harding, actually. He's been a backup in the playoffs. But it is a concern for me because Brizgalov, as we know, he can be excellent, but he can be terrible.
And that's the risk. And I want to look at the other side of it, Dave. And as you mentioned, Paul Stastny. But can we say enough about how good Nathan MacKinnon is this early in his career?
He's the second youngest player ever to score 3 points in his first playoff game. The other one was Pierre Turgeon.
Pierre Turgeon, interesting. Was that Buffalo or the Islanders?
He was on the Islanders back then, wasn't he?
Yeah, drafted by Buffalo, though.
Yeah. Right, Buffalo.
We'll get Remus on that one. What I look at MacKinnon and I see Junior Crosby. I really do, guys. I mean, he does everything at full speed, and he's become a dominant player almost at 18, 19. I mean, I'm not sure if he's got his 19th birthday yet. The point is, him amongst those other talented forwards without Duchene is a scary proposition. Dave, what did you think of MacKinnon's first game and the rest of those forward, as you mentioned, O'Reilly and some of the other guys they have there?
You know what? It was interesting because as we were watching all the, you know, we had a lot of games on when we were sitting down watching it, and you're sitting there and you're thinking to yourself, okay, Minnesota's up 4-2, which was surprising, right? Like, I remember I looked over and I thought, how did it become 4-2? And then all of a sudden, Colorado just seemed to turn it on. And you just saw the way these young forwards with their legs, and it's like they don't realize that they're not supposed to win. Even though they've kind of vaulted from 29th to 1st, you really have seen them, like these guys. And the fact of the matter is they're doing this without Duchene is really impressive. Because Minnesota, you think of a lockdown team. When they've got a 4-2 lead, you think that's a fairly safe lead. Even you can say what you want about Brizgalov, the way this style of play that Minnesota plays, you're anticipating that they're going to lock down a 4-2 lead. And Colorado showed no let up, and it really was impressive. And honestly, MacKinnon is part of that.
And I just to mention quickly, Richie here, I don't think the Minnesota Wild are this series. I didn't think was going to be long, anyways. But I don't think if this is their game plan, I don't think they might not even win one game. The Minnesota Wild, as we've seen against the Jets here, they play the old New Jersey Devils, the old Jacques Lemaire style. Keep the game low scoring. Wait for turnovers. They opened it up yesterday, and I should say 2 nights ago. And I think if that's their strategy to play run and gun with the Colorado Avalanche, they're going to lose because they don't have a goalie that they can depend on to make the big saves. I think Varlamov has the advantage there for Colorado, and I think they need to get back to the Minnesota Wild system, which is defensive, patient hockey.
If I'm Minnesota, I'm concerned I didn't win game one because I ought to have won game one, and I don't think Colorado played their best game, and that's what I'd be somewhat concerned. Something about Mike Yeo there, though. I'm not buying what he's selling, and I haven't been all year.
Yeah, you were sour on him when they played here in Winnipeg.
I just don't think that he coaches to the talent. I think he coaches to what he wants. I think he's trying to fit a square peg in a round hole, as far as I'm concerned. I could be wrong. So it certainly wouldn't be the first time, but I think Patrick Waugh is going to outcoach him in this series, and I think he probably did in game one. When we come back, Rangers-Flyers. That was an interesting first game. Pittsburgh and Columbus. Every series has been interesting. We're going to break those two down next on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 129.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
On TSN 1290.ca.
Three segments down, one segment to go in the first hour of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. Richard Pollock filling in for the soon-to-be-returning Drew Mindell, who's still vacationing in the southern states of the United States of America. Joined in studio by Ezra Ginsberg and David Manouk of IllegalCurve.com. Guys, we've talked about 6 of the 8 series thus far. We have yet to talk about the Rangers and Flyers and the Pens and the Blue Jackets, but I want to start with the Rangers and Flyers. And you look at the score, if you didn't watch that game, you say, oh, 4-1 Rangers, and you know Philly didn't get a lot of shots on net, and so the Rangers were the better team. And I don't disagree with the fact that the Rangers were the better team. But that was a 1-1 game before the Flyers take a double minor and the Rangers look dominant on the power play. What do you read into that result? And, I mean, guys, I guess we have to talk about the fact that the Rangers, I mean, the Flyers just cannot win at MSG. It's been a long time since they've gotten a W while leaving MSG.
And I didn't think that, you know, I was expecting it to be a lot closer. And then, you know, that double minor really did change the game. I mean, obviously, because, you know, it was fairly tight. I actually didn't think the Rangers were really generating much while watching it. And then all of a sudden, next thing you know, scores out of hand. And then it's simply because they've, you know, been able to take advantage, which is important. And obviously, as you just said, Rich, the Flyers have had troubles in New York. So, I mean, it's an interesting series. I didn't think Rick Nash was noticeable at all, to be honest with you. I was kind of hoping that he was going to do something.
But now there was Giroux. I mean, McDonough got nailed on that first goal by Philly, and obviously certainly was one of the reasons why they scored there. Hartnell plows him into the boards, makes a pass to McDonald, the puck's in the net. But aside from that, and I know it's one goal, but McDonough and Girardi absolutely shut down Giroux, Hartnell, and Voracek.
And that's what we said was going to be the case going into this series. That's the most dangerous line on the team. And we got to give Philly credit, though. They do roll out four lines.
Well, they'd have to score that. That's, I agree. Right. They'd have to score.
And especially three scoring lines. And when you've got Matt Reed there on the third line with Sean Couturier, even though Sean Couturier, they're going to put him in a position to match up against other teams' top lines, they can still score goals. And Matt Reed had a 20-goal year again this year. So the Philadelphia Flyers have depth there, but those two lines didn't have it in Game 1. So you're right, Richie. The first line was shut down. The New York Rangers got timely goals. Carl Hagelin's goal, I thought, was really nice. We were watching the game live there.
But you look at two penalties. You look at two power play goals by the Rangers. Brad Richards moving the puck really nice in that power play. The whole team really moving it well. But Brad Richards, I think, being the catalyst there. And then you look at the fourth goal. Braden Schenn falls down, and then Hagelin ends up getting open because it's a 3-on-3 that turns into a 3-on-2 because he falls down. So I mean, you take away a penalty and one guy falling down, it's a 1-1 game. If you're Philly, if you're the Rangers, well, you worked for it, you got it, and all that stuff. The Rangers' speed was causing problems for Philly. Will Philly's size combat that? And I think that's one thing they need to get better at, is getting the puck in deep and using their size against this team. And I thought the Flyers were kept to the outside a little bit and were dumping it in far too much. And they have too much talent to be dumping and chasing like that continually. I know they want to get in the forecheck, and I know they want to be physical. And there's a place and time for that, for getting into the corner, but you can't do it all the time. And I thought that was one of the reasons why the Rangers were able to get the puck in and out, because Philly was giving up the puck far out more often than they had to.
Right, and that's when the second line with Braden Schenn and Braden Schenn there with Wayne Simmonds, that line there, that's a line that really has to come through physically.
Right. That's right.
And they have to score. And and that goes to the Couturier line as well with Matt Reed. If that line is going to be shut down, and I know, Richie, that you're one of the biggest Ryan McDonough fans out there. And
top five defender.
That pairing, guys, is really almost as dominant in a sense as Seabrook and Keith for the Chicago Blackhawks. Yeah. They really are. And the New York Rangers, as we've seen time and time again, and this goes back to when Torts was coaching the New York Rangers, this team has the ability to shut teams down completely, and good teams, because even though the Philadelphia Flyers might have been the sixth seed in the Eastern Conference, this is a team that was dominant in the second half offensively. Mm-hmm. Voracek was great, and Giroux, people are talking about Giroux as a possible Hart candidate. I don't want to get into that right now, but he really was good after the first month and a half of the season. So the New York Rangers, once you get down to the second line, the second D pairing, that's where I feel that they can take advantage. But you get
Stahl's good. It's Strawman, a little concern there.
But you get back to what you're asking, Richie, about the size. Absolutely. I mean, they're going to have to get some dirty goals here. They have to find a way to get some goals. And Lundqvist is one of the best goalies in the NHL. You're going to have to find a way, get some dirty goals, get in there, establish a cycle. And really, at certain points, the fourth line of the New York Rangers was dominating the Philadelphia Flyers. So they have to find a way to battle through here, because if you go back down 2-0, back to Philly, your chances statistically are just horrible. But against a team like the New York Rangers, you know, Richie, as you mentioned, you haven't been able to win a lot in MSG. You got to come back to Philly with at least a split.
I agree. I think in this series, these teams are evenly matched, but you give the Rangers some room there, and you're going to be in trouble. I want to move to Pittsburgh and Columbus. We're going to have Aaron Portsline of the Columbus Dispatch joining us in about 5 to 10 minutes here on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. Dave, I look at Columbus-Pittsburgh. You guys know I'm not sold on Pittsburgh this year, and I said that if Columbus had all hands on deck with Nick Foligno, RJ Umberger in the lineup, and Nathan Horton, I would have picked them to beat Pittsburgh, but with their injuries, I don't think that they are enough talent to beat Pittsburgh. However, they had two leads in Game 1, they blew them, and do you think David, that was one of those missed opportunities that they're going to look back to regret? Or do you think Columbus's perspective is, hey, we were in that game, we probably ought to have won it or close to it, and we're going to give these guys a run?
I think they're probably thinking they're going to give these guys a run, but I think when you have a team like Pittsburgh who's a little bit fragile going in, that you really need to take advantage of that game one. Yeah. And you have Marc-Andre Fleury, who gave up, I think, 3 goals in his first 21 shots and then was pretty much lights out for the remainder of the game. And there's a guy who's probably the most scrutinized player in the entire playoffs. I don't think anybody is being looked at more than Marc-Andre Fleury and is being questioned more than Marc-Andre Fleury. So I think you really had an opportunity to kind of like step on the Penguins' throats, and at least, I mean, not necessarily for the whole series, but at least for that game. And that, I think that really is a critical game from a Columbus team that has very little playoff experience. It's only their second playoff series in franchise history, and I think that it was an opportunity missed.
Dave, they have 11 guys that have never been in the playoffs, so this team really lacks playoff experience. And when you look at that game, they had the 2-goal lead, and they were doing a great job. Crosby was being smothered by Brandon Dubinsky, and I don't think, by the way, that Sidney Crosby's a guy throughout a series that's going to necessarily keep him off the score sheet. I think Dubinsky is an excellent defensive forward, but I think in that game, you mentioned Marc-Andre Fleury, there are all these question marks. He's had the sub-900 save percentage since they won the Cup in 2009, but it was Sergei Bobrovsky who had the bad game. Matt Niskanen's goal, you got to stop that. Mm-hmm. Brandon Sutter's goal, you could even say that he should have stopped that. So Sergei Bobrovsky, a guy that we've mentioned, is really so important to this team because they don't have the defense that the Rangers have. They don't have the defense that the Hawks have. They rely on Bobrovsky, one of the best goaltenders in the league. I know it's hard to think of Bobrovsky as one of the best goaltenders in the league, but he really is. So to me, that was an opportunity lost, but it also showed the Pittsburgh Penguins that, hey, you're not going to just walk all over us in the series.
And they're going to be a physical team. I think one of the things that we're going to look at, you're going to look at is, the way Columbus is, you know, they play as more of a grind-you-out, bigger kind of team. I know they have some injuries, and we'll ask about it. I think Umberger's lining up is going to come back into the lineup, as he, and Nick Foligno's now questionable. Also, yeah. So, I mean, those would be interesting. But they're going to try and grind you below the hash marks a little bit.
Yep.
I think based on Pittsburgh's defensive style, the Columbus defensemen are going to be very important in terms of creating offense. Can they get their shots through? Are they going to jump into the play and pick some holes? Because you saw Jack Johnson with a goal and an assist in game one. And I think if Columbus wins, their defense have to get 5 goals in this series minimum.
And yeah, it's a good point. You mentioned Jack Johnson was excellent in game one. A guy like James Wisniewski is not afraid to jump into the rush. Sometimes he does it too much. And then Ryan Murray's an excellent skater. They'll try to activate him. Good Pierre Maguire term there. So I think you're right, Richie. I think especially without a guy like Nathan Horton in the lineup, and RJ Umberger and Nick Foligno, even if they do come back, they're coming in without some games here. Yeah, so you still are going to have to get, I'm agreeing with you, and they're still going to have to get offense from their defense here. But to me, it all comes down to Bobrovsky. If Bobrovsky is letting in 5 goals a game, they don't have a chance.
I totally agree with you there. And let's break this series down further. We're going to have Aaron Portsline of the Columbus Dispatch joining us after the break to talk more about Columbus and Pittsburgh, whether the Blue Jackets are for real and can possibly upset one of the Stanley Cup favorites. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.
1 hour down, 2 hours to go on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. Richard Pollock filling in the host chair for Drew Mindell, who returns next Saturday. That'd be, what, April 26th, I believe, if my Manitoba math, to steal a phrase from Rick Ralph.
Looks like Drew was gone for about a month and a half.
Yeah, I wish we all
What's
had.
What's he been doing? Isn't he work?
I wish we all had, you know, a month off every 3 months.
I think I've taken a day off. Maybe 3 days.
David Manuk of IllegalCurve.com.
David never takes a day off.
And Azzy Ginsburg of Illegal Curve.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We were breaking down the Columbus-Pittsburgh series before the break, and now we're joined by Aaron Portsline of the Columbus Dispatch to give us further insight into the Columbus perspective. Aaron, nice of you to join us this Saturday morning. How are you?
Well, I'm very well. Thanks for having me.
Well, Aaron, thanks for joining us. I want to get into, you know, when you talk about this series and you looked at, some people thought a mismatch in terms of talent. I think they're probably a mismatch in terms of talent. But Columbus comes out in the first game. They get 2 leads, and obviously they aren't able to hold the leads. What did you make, like, what do the Blue Jackets take from game one? We were talking before the break. Do they look at it as from the perspective of, you know, we blew a great chance to get a lead on this team, or we can play with these guys, and if we keep doing this, we'll be okay?
I think the message is a little confused, honestly. I think there were some positive signs in there. I mean, the fact that
you've got Crosby, Malkin, and Letang pissed off in game one. Might be a good thing. Maybe that's something you can build on. That suggests that you're getting in on the forecheck and hitting them in a way they don't like to be hit.
Mm-hmm.
I still get the sense, and I think this is a carryover from the regular season, that when the Penguins need something to happen, they just simply push their foot down on the pedal and get it done. I mean, Columbus takes a 3-1 lead early in the second, and kaboom, the lead's gone. It's 3-3. And, you know, Pittsburgh's now got the game back in control. I mean, they can play with these guys on some level. I just think they have yet to show that they can dictate how the game is played for long stretches. They can hang with them. I'm not sure that they can drag them around the ice in the way that they want to play the game.
Aaron, you touched on this a little bit, and I know I read your post on the Columbus Dispatch. You wrote about this. Sidney Crosby was seeing a steady dose of Brandon Dubinsky in that game. Brandon Dubinsky was all over him. I think he finished with 8 or 9 hits, and he was basically shadowing him. Do you think that Todd Richards is going to continue to use Brandon Dubinsky in that capacity as a shadow on Crosby, and do you think that's a good strategy moving forward?
Well, I think he'd be foolish to go away from after what game one looked like. I mean, you know, Crosby wasn't exactly shut down in that game. He did have an assist, but he was certainly held in check. He was -2. There's at no point did he appear to take over that game and overwhelm Columbus. I mean, you know, Dubinsky's probably the guy that is most capable of handling Crosby. If any one player is, he's pretty quick. He's pretty nasty. He's physical. He's strong. But if you know Dubinsky at all, he can be a bit of an a-hole on the ice, which is, I think, the approach that they have to take here. If Dubinsky doesn't work out, if something happens the rest of the way, the Penguins adjust and Crosby starts to take over that matchup, I think they could possibly go to Artem Anisimov, who saw a lot of Crosby when he played with the Rangers. But for now, it's Dubinsky, and the way that game one went, I think Richards would be foolish to try to get away from that.
We're joined by Aaron Portsline of the Columbus Dispatch, breaking down Columbus versus Pittsburgh. Aaron, on that same point, Dubinsky on Crosby, it's almost, you know, a little bit more old-fashioned in that he's kind of shadowing him around the ice, a la, you know, the classic Steve Kasper on Wayne Gretzky. Why that style of defending Crosby as opposed to kind of the line matching, a little bit more of the three-guys-on-three-guys defense?
Well, there's been that. You know, it's been Calvert, Dubinsky, Atkinson, that line. I just think, you know, Columbus's thing all season has been rolling four lines, trusting all four lines. None of these lines scare you. None of them. Mm-hmm. But I think there's a healthy respect for all of these lines because they all have very, very solid all-zone type games. They check well. They skate well. Pretty fast team. I don't know that Todd Richards has disrupted his lines to have Dubinsky over the boards literally every time Crosby did. I think there were 6 shifts in Wednesday's opener in which Crosby played against somebody other than Dubinsky. So I don't think it's just Dubinsky as a pure shadow on Crosby. The other thing, too, and game one maybe isn't the best example because it was Pittsburgh that had the second change. I mean, coming out of timeouts, Bylsma puts his guys on the ice after Columbus does. So Bylsma was looking at the Crosby-Dubinsky matchup as much as Richards was for some reason, although Bylsma's point after the game was that he was looking for defensive matchups more than he was center matchups.
Yeah, he really doesn't match lines, even in the Olympics there, and he really didn't seem to get, you know, preoccupied with line matching.
That went well.
Aaron, the Blue Jackets had 48 hits in Game 1 against the Pens, including 7 from Boone Jenner, who was battling with Chris Letang all night. Have the Jackets targeted Letang?
They have. You could say, have they targeted and then leave a blank line there for Pittsburgh Penguins? Yes. Yes is the answer. Especially Letang, especially Malkin, especially Crosby. I think those three guys are seen as the head of the beast, if you will. When they're angry and they respond in a way that takes them out of their element, these guys can hit can play on the playground, but they don't like fighting on the playground. That's the reputation. And I think the Blue Jackets, while not admitting it or not saying that they're going to try the Philadelphia style. When you see Letang spearing Boone Jenner, and when you see Malkin horse collar Dubinsky, and you see Crosby on the ice and Dubinsky cross-checking him and leaning on him and keeping him there on the ice, those should be seen as all good signs for the Blue Jackets. Their only hope in this series, let's not kid ourselves, is that Fleury is last April's Fleury, and that they can be some sort of villain to these Penguins. They have to be the more physical team. It's just that simple.
You know, we're joined by Aaron Portsline, the Columbus Dispatch, and Aaron was saying the segment before, I'm not really sold on Pittsburgh, and if Columbus had all hands on deck, I actually would have picked the Blue Jackets, and they're going to get some of these players back. Umberger's in the lineup tonight, and Foligno's questionable. Can you give us an update on those two guys?
Yeah, Umberger's going to play. He's on a line with Anisimov, and at this point, Blake Como on the right side. I think Foligno's going to play as well. 2 days ago, the club said he was out. That day he skated in an optional skate and looked terrific. Yesterday he skated full practice with the team, looked tremendous. They had an assistant coach put him through battle drills. Dan Hynote, former NHLer, you know, he takes this perverse thrill in being the last line of whether these players can play or not. Takes them out on the ice. They do battle drills. Puck goes into the corner. Hynote crushes him, hits him. Takes all sorts of liberties with him that he couldn't do as a player without getting blowback, but he gets to now. And that's sort of the last line. And Hynote came off the ice yesterday, and his direct words to Todd Richards were, Nathan looks, or Foligno looks great, by the way. So my sense is he's going to play.
Aaron, I think you'd agree that Sergei Bobrovsky didn't have his best game in Game 1, letting in 5 goals on 33 shots. The Niskanen goal and the Sutter goal come to mind as far as not maybe the best goals, and Bobrovsky most likely wants those back. But you mentioned this in the Columbus Dispatch, which I thought was very interesting. Dating back to Bobrovsky's days in Philadelphia, remember he was pulled for Brian Boucher, he's never won a game in the playoffs. Did you ever think that Bobrovsky's poor play as opposed to Fleury's poor play would be the storyline, I guess, so far in this series?
That was the real surprise of Game 1. The first part of the game, when it's 3-1 early in the second, you could feel in Console Energy Center, I almost said at Mellon Arena, in the Penguins barn, you could feel this sense of, oh, God, here we go again. Because Fleury was not – there were a couple opportunities I think Fleury could have had saves and didn't stand up to it. And then, you know, he made a couple of big saves. He stopped a guy you'll be familiar with, Matt Calvert, on a breakaway. Big time save, poke check. The other end of the ice is where the problem was, and Sergei Bobrovsky was shaky. And you can't, you know, it's easy to say that those were different times with the Philadelphia Flyers, and maybe his numbers in the playoffs before this year should be thrown out. But, you know, after a while, I do think it becomes telling. He's 0-3. He's got a save percentage of .855 in the playoffs, a goals against well over 4. He has not played well in the playoffs. They need him to be a decidedly better goaltender than Marc-Andre Fleury if they're going to have a chance.
Aaron, the third pairing of Nikita Nikitin and David Savard struggled at times against Pittsburgh's bottom line. Do you expect the bottom forward line, sorry. Do you expect head coach Todd Richards to make any changes heading into Game 2?
I asked him that yesterday. He said, nope, same six, no changes. So Dalton Prout and Nick Schultz remain as healthy scratches. They would really like Dalton Prout to be back to Dalton Prout of last year, and he struggled with that mightily. He's been there a little bit, but has not quite held down that spot. Really big, physical guy who actually moves pretty good, but he's had a hard time staying on pace this year.
We talked before, and we're joined by Aaron Portsline of the Columbus Dispatch. Aaron, Ezra brought up a good point last segment. 11 guys on this Blue Jackets team have no playoff experience. I mean, it's only been one game, but have you noticed that at all in terms of deer in headlights look?
You know, not really. That's the one thing I think, another thing that was uplifting if you're from the Blue Jackets' perspective in that Game 1 is that Boone Jenner did not look at all out of his element. I didn't think Ryan Johansson was great, but he didn't look overwhelmed. I didn't think Ryan Murray did either. It's pretty stunning. Like, I ran the numbers before this series started, and the lineups that were on the ice in Game 1, Pittsburgh's guys had 800 wow. more playoff games than the Blue Jackets players did. Right, I mean, that is a
crazy,
stunning
yeah.
figure. But I didn't sense any of the young players being overwhelmed. I think they can play better. Maybe it slowed them down a bit, but I didn't see any of the the jitters and their play being totally incapable because of their nerves.
Final question for you. From a strategy perspective, you know, Columbus is a bigger team, getting two of their guys likely back today, as you mentioned. Pittsburgh likes to collapse a lot in the defensive zone. How important is it going to be for Columbus's defense to be able to create offense and join, maybe not only join the rush, but also be able to create offense when the Columbus has some kind of sustained pressure in the offensive zone?
You know, I think they'd be okay with that. I think they're actually better positioned than a lot of teams in the East for that. You saw Jack Johnson being very active mm-hmm. offensively in Game 1. I mean, the first goal that they scored, it was a gorgeous setup by Dubinsky, but the fact that Johnson was coming through the right wing and then was so low, that overwhelmed.
Do we still have Aaron, or we lose Aaron there? I think we lost Aaron. But Columbus and Pittsburgh play tonight at 6 p.m. Central Time. That was great. Thanks of Aaron to give us his time there. Really interesting series from a lot of perspectives, and you know, you hear Aaron talk about Crosby, Malkin, Letang losing composure, the question of Fleury. We've seen that from Pittsburgh against Boston. We've seen that from Pittsburgh against Philly. Pittsburgh doesn't want to see that happen a third time, so it's going to be a very interesting game two tonight, and we're going to see exactly, you know, if the Pittsburgh Penguins have maybe learned from the past or are doomed to repeat it yet again. When we come back, we're going to move to Jets. Alexander Burmistrov makes some comments to a Russian reporter, Igor Aronko, who actually made the same reporter who had the story about Burmistrov being unhappy playing behind Oli Jokinen, not last season, obviously the season prior. We're going to talk about Burmistrov's comments and what it could possibly mean for the Winnipeg Jets for the 2014-2015 regular season. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Boschman, he'll snap it up on the right side. Bogosian hustles across and gets it to Kane. Kane tried to relay it to Wheeler. Instead comes near side Burmistrov. Rashad scores! Alexander Burmistrov.
There you go.
What a great shot in his
Alexander
return to
Burmistrov.
The lineup.
He couldn't have tucked that the former lightning rod of the Winnipeg Jets, now that seems to be Andre Pavlik. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. Richard Pollock, David Manuka of IllegalCurve.com, and Ezra Ginsberg in studio. I'm not sure if Timmy intentionally played Money Talks. I wonder if Money will talk in this negotiations discussion, which will happen in 1 second. The segment's brought to you by Dr. Les Rikus and the Linden Market Dental Center. Whether an elite athlete or a weekend warrior, an essential part of your protective equipment is a proper fitting, custom-made mouth guard. Give yourself peace of mind protection as well as facial, teeth, and mouth protection. Contact the Linden Market Dental Center at 204-487-2226 or online at lindenmarketdentalcenter.com. Alexander Burmistrov, guys, is somebody that people love to talk about, in this town especially. It probably fits well with a center needed, and I was talking to Hustler and Lawless about that yesterday afternoon. I first want to hear what Paul Maurice had to say about Burmistrov and possibly bringing him back to the Jets. Then I want to get your guys' opinion on exactly what you think will happen and should happen.
If I'm asked to, I have very limited Russian that I picked up over there. But I have an appreciation for him as a player, as an opposing coach when he first came in. Really liked, he had a little bite to his game and he had some skill. And where he's at now in his career, knowing the league that he's played in, I'm not sure that's still there or if he has that interest in playing that style of game. But this guy was a very skilled, kind of gritty guy that could do some things for you offensively too. So, if I'm asked to, I would certainly be more than happy to present the style of game that we are going to play and our expectations of a player in our lineup, if that would help him make a decision on whether the Winnipeg Jets was the right place for him.
Boschman, he'll snap.
That was Paul Maurice, Winnipeg Jets head coach, now signed to a four-year deal, talking about Alexander Burmistrov, who has been playing in the KHL this past season. And may play in the KHL next season, or may play in Winnipeg next season.
No, Richie, I'll just sort of cut you off, but you know, Paul Maurice, maybe we could hook him up with a little Rosetta Stone or something.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, Paul Maurice talks about the style of play that they're going to play here. I don't know if that matters really. I mean, to Burmistrov's intention to come back, obviously matters when he's coaching Burmistrov whether he's following that style. But I think Burmistrov, I mean, he wanted to play top two last time, and he didn't like being behind Olli Jokinen. So if he's coming back now, he's going to be playing third-line center behind Scheifele and Little. Will he want to play third-line center? I mean, are they going to play a top nine that likes to score more? Is he going to be playing in a defensive role? Is he going to get any power play time? I mean, the power play in the Jets isn't very good, but there's certainly some space for guys who can create. But I guess my question is, if the reason he left was because he wasn't getting the ice time he wanted, where is that ice time going to be if he comes back?
I think you make a good point. And regardless of the style, guys, a third line center, especially in the Western Conference, I think, is going to have to be good on faceoffs. He's going to have to be responsible defensively, and he's going to have to finish his checks, be physical. I think you make a good point. How many teams have the third line that the Boston Bruins have, right? Mm-hmm. Not many teams have third lines that have 20 goal scorers. Carl Soderberg was on the third line, for example, with Riley Smith on the Boston Bruins, guys that each had over 50 points. Not everybody rolls out third line. So obviously you want some scoring from your third lines. You want scoring from all four of your forward lines, right? But for Burmistrov, if they're going to bring him back, and the intention, I don't know right now if the intention is to bring him back. I think it's to explore bringing him back. But if he is to come back, he doesn't have an option, Richie, because as you mentioned yesterday on HNL, Mark Scheifele is slotted in as the second line center, and Brian Little is slotted in as the second line center, first line center, not only for the foreseeable future, short term, but the long term. I mean, this is the plan for the Jets. The Jets have developed Scheifele to this point, and Burmistrov is a third line center. And as we know, he had a problem playing behind Olli Jokinen 2 years ago. So when you first asked me this yesterday, Richie, about bringing Burmistrov back, I said, well, he's going to have to stop doing too much and dangling in the neutral zone and trying to pretend that he's Pavel Bure all the time. Yeah. He doesn't have that ability, and I don't think the Jets want him to be that type of player. Burmistrov's a first-round pick, and they have to recoup something if he's not going to come back, in the sense that they trade him or they eventually part ways. But he's an asset for the Jets in the short term and in the long term. But if he isn't committed to playing that role and becoming a better player, all-around player, then I don't see why you would bring him back. Because Burmistrov, towards the end of his tenure, and it was a short tenure, his time in Winnipeg, he wasn't playing very well, and Claude Noel was benching him. So let's not pretend that Burmistrov was a dominant player who the Jets should do everything to get back. He's not that good, but I think he can, at his age, 22 years old, he can still be a valuable NHL player. But is his head in it, and does he want to play in North America, or does he want to stay in the KHL?
That's a good question. I mean, I agree with you, Ezzy, that people have glorified his tenure in Winnipeg. 100% they've glorified it. He's not as good as some people have said he was. And I don't love his game, but I still bring him back if the possibility is there, because he's better, likely, in terms of cost-benefit. He hasn't cost you anything aside from money. He can play center, and you have a need at center. And if you bring him back, you don't like what he has, teams see that he's back, you can trade him, as opposed to just having him sit in Russia and you get nothing for him and you lose an asset for nothing. This is a quote from Igor Aranko. He's from sportsexpress.ru, I believe. So you can find it on the internet if you can read Russian or want to use Google Translate. This is Alexander Burmistrov's comments. I'm glad the Jets remember me regarding Shevoldayev's comments. Time will tell regarding whether or not he comes back after the summer. He says any decision will be made after the World Championships. So, I mean, something can be read into that, but at the end of the day, I mean, he's not an idiot either. He wants to have leverage. And I wonder, Dave, let me ask you this. I wonder if the Jets are going to like the games that he plays.
You know what? It's interesting in the sense that, just getting back to one thing you guys were just talking about, there really was a perfect storm, because you had a second line center last year in Olli Jokinen who was underperforming, and then we didn't have Alex Burmistrov to be able to take that spot. So everybody kind of filled it in. You know what I mean? People fill in the blanks. Mm-hmm. They say, oh, he could have been playing that role. He could have been the guy, but we didn't have him as an asset. And so that's kind of, you know, that's what you talk about when you're like, there's a fondness for people to think, to wax poetic and go, oh, this guy could have been that. We don't know that he could have been that. He may have been able to, but you don't know until you actually see it. You know what? The truth is this, and I thought Coach Maurice's comments were telling. He said, if he chooses to play our style, basically saying, And if you listen to Coach Maurice, he's literally said throughout the season, his experience in the KHL taught him, you can't have guys come over here and expect them to adopt our culture, and it's not an easy transition. And trust me, if I was plopped down in Russia, it would be difficult. It wouldn't be easy for me to just be like, oh, sure.
Except you speak fluent Russian.
До свидания. But the point is that it would be somewhat problematic. So I can understand how you've got a a coach in Maurice who because he said himself when he was first in the NHL, right, he wouldn't have played. He played his Russian players like he played his North American players and treated them, not even necessarily played them, but treated them in that same manner. And he said that it was without a certain amount of empathy. What he's saying now is he would change that. But having said that, he's still going to have an expectation that Burmistrov is going to come in and play within his system. It's not the other way around. Burmistrov's not going to come here and play the game that he likes to play. He has to be prepared to do whatever this coaching staff wants.
Burmistrov can't play top six in the National Hockey League right now. He's not a top six center in the National Hockey League, as far as I'm concerned.
And he's still young, Richie.
No, that's the point. And so he's still going to come back and he's going to play third line center. Does he right. want to play that to learn how to play and be able to create offensive entry if there's injuries or other opportunities? Maybe there is. He's got to be willing to do that. And if he's not willing to do that, then they're not going to bring him back, I don't think.
I think what it comes down to is, do you want to be a team player? I mean, ultimately, the Jets could use... I mean, you're kidding yourself. You don't think the Jets could use him as a third-line center.
And it comes down to money.
No, of course. And
more
that's
money there.
There's way more money in the KHL. And, I mean, again, I don't know the tax ramifications there versus here, but, I mean, I'd imagine there's a few loopholes in the KHL system that allows you to save a little bit more money.
Yeah, there's some brown paper bags that can be exchanged. But, no, but you look at Burmistrov, and Richie mentions the money. That's an aspect. Dave mentions his commitment to be a team player. And to me, it's a commitment to play in North America as a whole. And that's not just financially, but you look at all of the players and the numbers of Russian players is dwindling in the NHL. Yeah. It's mind-boggling that 10 years ago there were three or four times more Russian players, but if it's Alexander Radulov or Ilya Kovalchuk, the list goes on and on of guys that have decided to go play in the KHL. So if he doesn't have that commitment to make a hockey pro hockey career out of himself in North America, then this conversation is really, you know, irrelevant, because he has the ability to play in his home country and make a nice living and play the way he wants to play. He also has the opportunity in certain respects to make more money and prove that he's in the best league in the world here in North America. So really, right now, it's kind of a question mark, because I think the Jets are looking at Burmistrov, Richie, and they're saying, okay, if we're going to make him an NHL player and commit to him, it's got to be now. I don't think they want to wait 2 or 3 years down the road to see if maybe Alexander Burmistrov. I think they're going to either give him a chance now or cut ties with him. That's what I think. That's my personal perspective. He either comes back and plays next year, or we'll never see him as a Winnipeg Jet.
David?
You know what? I really don't know. No. It's interesting. I mean, we'll see if Coach Maurice has a conversation with him when he's overseas and kind of
both be the World Championships, I believe.
Yeah, we're not 100% sure if Maurice is going to be playing for Russia at the World Championships.
Yeah, starts May 9th.
But if there is, I mean, Maurice has indicated a willingness to have a conversation with him while he's down there. You know, and again, he might need, as I said, the Rosetta Stone to have some translation. But you know what? I really have no idea. The team could go either way. I mean, clearly, it all depends also what they're going to do with Jokinen. I mean, if you have Jokinen as your third line center, you bring him back. I mean, we're going to talk about that in the next segment, based on what he's willing to accept on his contract. If you have Jokinen as your third line center, now, of course, that's kind of saying you want an older, experienced guy who's not going to necessarily be here for the long haul. If you think Burmistrov could be here for the long haul, then you obviously want to bring him back to the fold and say, okay, he could be part of that core of our team moving forward for years to come.
It's a perfect segue, because next two segments, we're going to talk about Olli Jokinen. What's his market value? What's the expected contract that we think he will get? And whether the Jets should bring him back or let him go. You're listening to the Legal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290.
You've been listening to the Legal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
Catch the Legal Curve Hockey Show live Saturdays on TSN 1290 and TSN 1290.ca.